Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Great to have you tuned in today. Thanks for joining us here on Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Ross at the controls. Chris is at the phones. And today, Ted, we're going to talk about your brain.
My brain? I don't think you want to go there.
We're going to find out today that what you believe about God actually changes your brain.
Yeah, our perception of God has a lot to do with our faith walk and just our life.
Looking forward to discovering more about the God-shaped brain. I was just listening moments before the program to James McDonald, Walking the Word, and he's just begun a new series about how we think and talking about tearing down strongholds. Mm. And we know that Paul tells us that we should take every thought captive. So we're going to find out more about that today in the first half of today's program. In the second half of the program, we're going to focus on mental health because mental health is like gardening. We need solid grounding, and we're going to learn about gardening your life in the second half of today's show. So it'll be good conversation as we think about how we can think properly and rightly, and then out of that comes right actions. Yesterday I had a wonderful conversation with Kay Warren. If you missed it, I want to encourage you to go online and listen to it. It would be a wonderful podcast to send to a friend. She and Rick have gone through, of course, great loss in the loss of their son, 27 years old, taking his own life. And so she shares vulnerably about that as well. So I just want to encourage you to listen to that. And out of that conversation, we talked a little bit about mental health, and it's appropriate that we have an opportunity to learn more about how changing our view of God can transform our life. My guest today is Dr. Timothy Jennings. Tim's a board-certified Christian psychiatrist, a master psychopharmacologist. He's a lecturer, international speaker, and author, voted one of America's top psychiatrists by the Consumers Research Council of America in the 3 years running. And he is president of the Tennessee Psychiatric Association, also on the board of the Southern Psychiatric Association, private practice in Tennessee. And he's written a fine resource called The God-Shaped Brain, How Changing Your View of God Transforms Your Life. It's from University Press. We had Dr. Jennings on maybe a year or so ago, and we're honored to have him back. Dr. Jennings, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Glad to be here, and thanks for having me.
There's so much we're learning about the brain more and more all the time, and I know this has been your area of study and research, and we could talk about, concussions and all those things, but I think we want to just jump into, the idea that your view of God could actually transform your life. And you talk a lot about sin, that because of sin, our brains don't naturally function the way God designed. So let's start there. What do you mean by that?
Well, God designed us for love. He designed us for love and trust relationships with him and with each other was our original design. But what happened when sin entered is that we had another motive that actually has altered our brain structure. And the scientists call this today survival of the fittest, but the primary drive is fear. As soon as Adam and Eve sinned, they ran and hid because they were afraid. And we have this biological wiring, which we are egocentric, self-centered, and fear-driven. And this fear actually drives us to watch out in self-protective ways, which inhibits our ability to love well. And since the Bible teaches that perfect love casts out all fear. Well, this isn't just experience. It is actually neurobiological. And the studies show that when you worship a God who is love, a God who is benevolent, a God who is compassionate, a merciful God, a God who is revealed in Jesus Christ, when you meditate on a God like this, you actually grow circuits in your brain, anterior cingulate cortex, where you experience empathy, compassion, other-centered regard. And when these circuits are active, it turns off our brain's fear circuitry, the amygdala. We have less anxiety and fear, perfect love, casting out fear neurobiologically.
That is really profound. I mean, we know that we understand that the brain has sort of plasticity, but it also gets sort of in patterns, right? So it is about, in fact, changing the pathways, right?
It's exactly about this. And this is what early childhood development is so important. The child brain is so pliable. So much change is happening. Millions of neurons are being deleted. Wiring is happening in those first 8 years of life. And so healthy nurturing, healthy loving atmosphere in childhood actually causes the brain to develop with less sensitive fear circuitry. In other words, they're less anxious, less fearful individuals. But if they have childhoods of neglect, childhood of abuse, childhood of abandonment, these types of childhood, actually you get a different brain where you have even more upregulated fear circuitry. So individuals enter adolescence and adulthood with more anxiety, more fear that they then have overcome later in life. So this is the battle between the love circuits, the compassion circuits, and the fear circuits in our being.
It sounds like kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy or maybe a downward spiral, right? Once we get into that, the more fear leads to our brain sort of, you know, focusing on that more, which leads to more fear, right?
That's exactly what happens when you begin to gratify the fear circuitry. When you become, think about relationships. I know you've seen them that are fear-driven relationships. People that are insecure and fearful, and they go into a relationship in which they're afraid of abandonment, afraid of being rejected, afraid of not being liked, afraid of being left for somebody else. And so they're suspicious, they're paranoid, they're jealous, they're controlling, and that type of behavior because they're afraid of losing somebody. So they're monitoring, they're watching behind, they're critical. And what happens to the relationship? It poisons the relationship, which only confirms the fact that they weren't wanted, which makes them more fearful the next time, and it's reinforcing.
You talk about something called brain fertilizer and how we want to keep that flowing in our brains. Is that actually something real or just changing our thoughts?
Yeah, I use the term fertilizer. It's actually called brain-derived, meaning the brain makes it, neurotrophic factor, and other factors like this. These are proteins the brain makes that when these proteins hit the neural circuits, they will cause the neurons to make new neurons, to branch out new connections, so you can actually learn quicker and easier and so forth where this is made available. And what happens is the protein that is produced off the DNA is actually called pro-brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and the pro-brain-derived neurotrophic factor, instead of actually being the fertilizer, it's like weed killer to the neuron. So if that hits the neuron, it will cause the neuron to be pruned back, whereas if the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, hits it, that will actually cause a neuron to grow. And what determines whether you get the weed killer or the fertilizer is an enzyme that will cleave the weed killer into the fertilizer. And what determines whether you get that, this is really cool, is the activity of the neural circuit itself. If you're using the neural circuit, it produces the enzyme. The enzyme will cleave this protein into the fertilizer and the circuit grows stronger. But if you stop using the circuitry, then you stop the enzyme, and then this weed killer comes in and the circuit begins to get pruned back. And so think about in high school, maybe you're taking a foreign language class, and you were studying by brute force memory, learning new words. And if you kept actively trying to memorize words, then you're activating new neural connections. This enzyme is produced. The fertilizer is produced, and you begin sprouting a network there. And if you keep practicing over 6 months, a year, 2 years of foreign language, your vocabulary increases, your syntax increases, because you're producing this fertilizer, and this circuitry is expanding. But then you graduate. 15, 20 years go by, you haven't spoken that language, you haven't activated that circuitry, you haven't produced the enzyme, and so the weed killer's been coming in, and it's prune it back, prune it back, prune it back. This is why the Bible says we must take every thought into captivity to Jesus Christ, because the same process of brain plasticity is involved in not just the things you activate overtly, but in your imagination. So if they've taken individuals and they put them in scanners, and they have them play a piece of music on a keyboard in their lap. And then they take the keyboard away, and they have them imagine playing the same piece of music, and the same neural circuits fire. So we can take pedophiles, we can lock them in prison, where they can't behaviorally act out, but can we control what they're thinking? No, we can't. And if they spend 20 years in prison, but they imagine their dastardly deeds, they will come out a more recidivist pedophile than they went in. We have to actually not just change behavior, we actually have to change our thoughts in order to actually have change in character, change in brain structure.
You know, as you talked about that passage in 2 Corinthians, it's taking every thought captive, but there's also, Paul talks about demolishing arguments. So say more about how those two need to go together.
Yes, and it says, you know, we don't wage wars, the world does. The weapons we fight with are not worldly. They have divine power to demolish strongholds. And notice we demolish every argument and pretension that sets itself up against the central issue, the knowledge of God, and take captive every thought. See, we are absolutely in a war over the conception of God that we hold. God is our creator. He built space, time, matter, life, energy. He is the source of all living things. And his laws are the laws upon which reality is actually constructed to operate, including laws of health, laws of gravity, laws of physics, laws of how relationships are constructed to work. When you deviate from those laws, it is actually harmful to us. It damages us. One of those design protocols is called the law of worship, or by beholding we become changed, or in psychiatry they call it modeling. But we actually become like what we admire, what we watch, what we engage in, what we adore. And thus when we hold deformed and distorted concepts of God, it changes us in negative ways. And so Paul says in Romans chapter 1, that they didn't think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. They exchanged the knowledge of God for images made with their own hands and so forth, and their minds became darkened, depraved, and futile. And science will actually show that the God that you worship actually causes a change in your own neurobiology. You're physically, structurally, and characterologically changed based on the God you worship, and only the God that is love, God of benevolent God, a God of love, is healing to our being. Every other God concept, angry, wrathful, punishing, distant God, is destructive to us.
So is it as simple as saying God is love? I mean, is that enough to kind of help change our understanding, or is there more?
Oh, it's much more than that, because most Christians actually say, if you went to a church on any Sunday and walked in and say, how many believe God is love? Well, what do you expect? Almost all the hands go up. There might be a few people struggling with an issue and they're angry, but 90% of the hands or so go up. Baylor University survey of views of God in America, however, found that only 23% of Americans actually worship a benevolent God. 32% worship a authoritarian dictator God, 24% a distant God, and 16% a critical God. And yet 75 to 80% of Americans are Christian. So just saying, I believe God is love, doesn't mean you actually worship a God who is love. You have to actually look deeper than that and ask the questions. The God that I worship, how does he function? How does he behave? What does he do? If you were to curse him to his face and spit on him and slap him, what would he do? Well, Jesus said, if you see me, you've seen the Father. And they did curse him, spit on him, and slap him. And he said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. That's the God who Jesus revealed. But if you worship a God like some people in the world do, that if you say something bad about his prophet, that they have to go into a rioting rampage and murder people, then see, that's a different God.
Dr. Tim Jennings joining us today. We're talking the God-shaped brain, how changing your view of God transforms your life. In fact, there's even a section in the book where he talks about the relationship between political orientation and the brain. I think we're going to have to talk about that in a moment because we are in that season. We're finding more about how changing your view of God transforms your life. We'll ask Dr. Jennings to just maybe share an example or two in his counseling practice, how he's helped people see God for who he really is and how that has brings about transformation. You can find out more by staying tuned here to Connecting Faith. Dr. Tim Jennings, board-certified Christian psychiatrist, lecturer, speaker, and author, and he is also president of the Tennessee Psychiatric Association. The book, The God-Shaped Brain, is our conversation here for the next few minutes. Stay tuned to Connecting Faith. God actually changes your brain. That's the premise in the book we're discussing for a few minutes with Dr. Timothy Jennings. Dr. Jennings is a Christian psychiatrist and a lecturer, a speaker, and author, and he's president of the Tennessee Psychiatric Association, among other responsibilities. The book, The God-Shaped Brain, How Changing Your View of God Transforms Your Life. And in that book, there's just a short little section that talks about the relationship between political orientation and the brain. And we were talking, you know, just a few minutes ago about that verse in Romans 1 about, the, you know, our minds become futile and just thinking, well, maybe there's not a connection, but it does seem like sometimes when we look at what's going on there, is there in fact a connection between the political orientation and the brain?
Well, you know, the point of that study that I was emphasizing is that any activity, whether it's politics or otherwise, that is fear-inducing, that uses fear to motivate people, then if it activates your fear circuitry, then that actually has negative cascades on us, and it changes our brain in negative ways. But activities that are altruistic, other-centered in its regard, seeking to help other people in an atmosphere of freedom, not coercion, then this is actually helpful. And so there was a brief study that just showed that certain political approaches are more fear-inducing, and we actually can see that they get more activation of their fear circuits when they approach it that way.
Well, you mentioned freedom, and what you talk about three keys, right? There's truth, love, and freedom. So talk about how they're linked.
Yes. So love can only exist in an atmosphere of freedom. And this is a very testable. It's not a claim that I'm making. You can test this in any relationship. Go to somebody that you're in a relationship and you want them to love you, and you put a knife to their throat and say, "Love me or I'm going to kill you." I mean, you instantly get that. You say, no, that doesn't work. You can't get love by coercing or threatening people. You can only get love by winning them to love in an atmosphere where they're free not to. And so God is a God of love. God is love. And this is why we have the freedoms that we have, because he wants our love in return. And you cannot get love by threats and coercive pressure. And many people miss this because human governments all work on coercion, sanctions, threats, punishments. Why is it that you obey the speed limit? Is it because you're in 30 in a 35 and a 30, and you don't go faster because of just complete altruism, or because there's a threat there? If you get caught, you're going to get a punishment. And this is how human governments work. But God's government doesn't work this way. God is the creator, the designer, the builder of reality, and his laws are an expression of his nature of love. Let me just give you a quick example, because Paul tells us in Romans 1 that God's divine nature is seen in what he has made, so that people are without excuse. And the law of love is the law of giving or beneficence. So let me give you an example. Every breath you take, you give away carbon dioxide to the plants, and the plants give back oxygen to you. A never-ending circle of giving upon which life is actually built and constructed. It's the law of love built right into nature. But you are still free, as a free immoral agent, to transgress the law. You can take a plastic bag, tie it over your head, selfishly hoard your carbon dioxide to yourself, but the wages of that is death. And you see this, and I give many examples in the book, and you see this all through scripture and reality, that when you deviate from God's design, it's always destructive to the deviant.
You know, talking about several passages, one passage I appreciate you just reflecting on out of Isaiah chapter 1, where God basically says to the children of Israel, look, I'm kind of tired of your sacrifices. I want you engaged. I think sometimes we think, well, is it okay to question and wonder and to really wrestle with God? To say more about that.
Yeah, Isaiah, it's a great passage, because here they are doing all these wonderful religious activities, sacrifices, feast days, Sabbath days, coming to temples worship, and he says, I'm sick of all this. Come, let us reason together. Though your sins are like scarlet, they'll be white like snow. Though they're red like crimson, they'll be made like wool. God is telling us that if we don't reason with him, we're not going to be cleansed from sin. How is that the case? Connect that with John 8:32, Jesus speaking. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. What does it set you free from? Well, Satan is the father of lies. In this text we just talked about in Corinthians, this is a battle for our minds on what we believe, particularly about God. And if we come to him with an attitude that sounds pious, but we refuse to think, well, God said it, I believe it, that settles it, I'm not going to ask questions, it doesn't make sense to me, his ways are higher than mine, I don't know why it makes sense that God would say, I love you, but if you don't love me, I'm going to torture you for all eternity and make you suffer, and I'm going to smile while I do it. These things make no sense. And so we should come to him and say, God, I don't understand. I want to understand you. And he'll say, well, for God so loved the world, he sent his only son. And you say, wait, I look to Jesus and I can actually see something about God, and you'll see how Jesus behaved and how he treated people. And when we draw those conclusions, we don't live in fear of our God. We recognize that our God has been working through Christ to reach us and to save us and to restore us. And then the fear goes away, and we're won back to love and trust.
You know, as you mentioned, the book has a lot of illustrations of how you've worked with various people in a variety of, maybe misunderstandings about the life. And maybe, I don't know if there's just an illustration you want to share. I know there's when you spent some time with a 15-year-old who just was assuming that God couldn't possibly love her. But just help us maybe by illustration to say, here's a way that we can think clearly about who God really is and how that's going to change our life.
I want to give you an illustration right from the opening chapter one of the book, because I think it's pertinent in this season of elections that we're talking about, where a young lady came to see me crying and very depressed because she was having trouble in her marriage getting pregnant, and she so much wanted a child. And she was feeling guilty, and she was feeling that it was her fault. And as I took the history from her, she told me that when she was a teenager, she'd gotten pregnant, and she had an abortion. And now her pastor told her that the reason she couldn't get pregnant was because God was punishing her for having the abortion. You see? And so we had to walk through this. The issue that she was struggling with was not the fact that she had the abortion. The issue she was struggling with was the fact that she believed now that God was punishing her for having the abortion. So her view of God wasn't, she didn't see God as God of grace, God of mercy, God of forgiveness, God who says, okay, you've made a mistake in your life, but I love you and I want to heal you and I want to restore you. Instead, she saw this God as a punitive God who was angry at her, who wanted to use his power to hurt her, and thus she lived under this oppression that was, it was hurtful to her, and we had to come back not to excuse early behavior in her life, but to help her realize that God, regardless of early behavior in her life, is our redeeming, saving, forgiving, gracious God who wants to heal and restore us, not this punitive being that we need to be protected from.
And it's going to take us maybe reading the scriptures with new eyes, with new lenses, right? Looking for maybe something that we hadn't seen before.
And I will tell you, the touchstone always, and of course, you know this, is Jesus Christ. I mean, he said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. The Father and I are one. So if you have some idea about what would God do, just go to Jesus and say, well, what did Jesus do? Because Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And this is the key to it all. And when we come to see God as Jesus revealed him to be, then we understand, yes, there's a real problem with sin, but sin is a condition of being, a state of sinfulness. That's why we want a new heart and right spirit. We want to have circumcision of the heart by the Spirit. We want to be partakers of the divine nature. We want the mind of Christ. We want the heart of stone removed, the heart of flesh put in. We want to be reborn and recreated in Christ's likeness. We don't simply want some accounting happening in a record book in a far-off galaxy where bad deeds have been recorded. We want transformation and renewal, and that only comes in a relationship with a God we can trust.
And the fact that it, our brains actually change. I mean, that renewal and transformation do start at the brain level, don't they?
Absolutely. When we come back to see God for who he is and we experience a God who is love, we calm our fear circuitry down, we advance and enhance our love circuitry. And studies show that individuals who are altruistic, who give of themselves to help others, they live longer, they have less depression, less dementia, stay out of nursing homes longer, and have less disability than people who don't volunteer to help others. The act of giving, the act of service to other people is actually healthy for our physical being.
Wow, it's been a fast 25 minutes. We need to have you come back and talk more. We'll have an opportunity, maybe don't put up the phone lines, take some listener questions. But Dr. Jennings, thank you so much for the good work you've done in this area and for the encouragement you've given just in this short time today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Timothy Jennings is a Christian psychiatrist, lecturer, speaker, and author. And he serves as the president of the Tennessee Psychiatric Association. He's written an important book called The God-Shaped Brain, How Changing Your View of God Transforms Your Life. Honored to have him with us today on Connecting Faith. Coming up in the second half of the program, we're going to talk about gardening your life and how, mental health is a lot like gardening. We need solid grounding. We'll get to that with Heidi Vermeerquist, who's a licensed clinical psychologist. So more on healthy thinking and healthy life just ahead here on Connecting Faith. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. So glad to have you tuned in. I'm Neil Stavem, and coming up here in the next half hour, we're going to spend some time talking gardening. Well, it's not actually really time for gardening yet, but we're going to talk about gardening your life. There's a new work that's just recently come out called Grounding, and it's the first in a three-part series on gardening your life, and we're going to hear more about it, and you'll find some practical help, I think, in the moments ahead. So glad to have you tuned in. Stick around as we talk with Heidi Vermeerquist. Heidi is a licensed clinical psychologist, as well as a wife, mother, musician, and family business consultant. And she helped about 10 years ago establish the Des Moines Clinic for Pine Rest Christian Mental Health Services. It's grown into a fully staffed outpatient mental health clinic. And her husband, Chad, have Vermeer Quist Consulting. They work with other family businesses to assess and improve business and ownership process. Part of the third-generation shareholder of Vermeer Corporation. But more importantly, she's written this wonderful little resource called Grounding, the first in a three-book personal growth series. And Heidi, welcome, by the way, to Connecting Faith. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you too, Neil. Thank you so much for having me.
We mentioned it's not necessarily the season of gardening, but we do want to talk about gardening your life. You, this is something that you've kind of put together in your work kind of through just your practice, right?
Correct, yes. You know, in the field of mental health, I just have, over the course of my practice and learning to ground my life in God's love and truth and wisdom, about 7-8 years ago, the concept of gardening just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I felt at that point already a call to look into Scripture about how God is like our master gardener. He teaches us how to ground our lives. And when we get pruned, it kind of feels like that grief, you know, that of losing something. And yet he works through grief. And so often when I work with people, they're going through some tremendous loss in their lives. And to be able to look at it as how they may learn from that and then have new growth, kind of started the ball rolling in this three-part series of Grounding, Grief, and Growing, the Gardening Your Life series. Yeah. So, happy to finally have released the first book, Grounding.
Well, tell me, you use the Serenity Prayer as the framework. Just say a bit about that. Why that particular well-known prayer?
The Serenity Prayer is tremendous. And in fact, most people know it, but they only know the first part of the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And when I was in my graduate school at Wheaton College, one of my favorite professors, he's actually a full-time clinician himself, but he taught our addictions class, he put that Serenity Prayer up, but he put the entire prayer up, which is so much more rich because it continues on with living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, and taking as Jesus did the sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, and trusting that you, Lord, are making all things right as I surrender to your will so that I am reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. That blew my mind because I had known about AA, I had known about recovery that had utilized that Serenity Prayer, and learning about that, internalizing that for myself for the last 15 years, there are so many wonderful skills as well as a posture in relationship with God that is grounding in that Serenity Prayer. And so it's cornerstone. Every group that I've led and I encourage church groups, all people even before they read a chapter in this book, is to start and end with that Serenity Prayer because it's just packed full of some good grounding concepts.
Well, when we're talking grounding, you have several sessions, I guess 10 sessions in this particular Gardening Your Life book. We probably won't get through all of them, but the first one you talk about is having a healthy Christian self-concept. What do you mean by that?
So we are constantly thinking, right? And we're often thinking about ourselves, and we see ourselves in a certain way. With a healthy Christian self-concept, you're choosing to adopt the way that God thinks of you, the way that the words within the Bible, the words that Jesus says about who you are, becomes your identity, your self-concept. So chapter one, right out the chute, I encourage people to think about, how do you think about yourself? What are your automatic thoughts about yourself? And not surprisingly to probably everyone listening, tends to be somewhat negative. We tend to be critical of ourselves. And not that we should think of ourselves as perfect, because that's sort of the other end of the spectrum that is unhealthy as well. But To think of ourselves as a child of God, first and foremost, is critical to good grounding. So I had to start there, right? Seeds to plant a sense of self that's rooted and focused in, I am a child of God, and I am loved, accepted, secure, significant.
It's helpful too. I mean, as you quote the question and answer number one to the Heidelberg Catechism, and you know, people probably many maybe grew up with you know, some of those foundational truths, but somehow just sort of being reminded of again was helpful to me.
Yeah, that's great. I don't know if many people know question and answer number one of the Heidelberg Catechism, but the first part of the Heidelberg Catechism, written centuries ago, is what is my only comfort in life and in death? That I am not my own is the answer. That I am not my own, but I belong body and soul in life and in death to my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. And it is just such a wonderful, again, belief to take in, to chew on, to digest, to embrace that my life is not my own, but I actually belong body and soul in life and in death to my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. So, yeah, so that I had to include that because I think, again, that really helps to cultivate that healthy Christian self-concept.
We're talking about sort of the seeds to garden your life and grounding it. You also talk about putting down roots for healthy boundaries, and boundaries certainly are a critical area. You also talk about, I think you refer to it as the ozone. Say more about that.
Yes. So I think a lot of mental health problems, and no one who breathes or is human is without mental health problems to some degree, because we have a brain, right? And our brains are going to think lots of thoughts, which is what it's supposed to do, by the way. Our brain is supposed to think, right? However, a lot of times we get stuck in what I like to call the ozone. And I know very little about the actual ozone when people hear the ozone, but I do know a lot about the mental health ozone, which I like to include then the three O's of others, outcomes, and old stuff. Had to keep it simple, so past didn't really work. I had to go with old stuff. But the ozone is others, outcomes, old stuff, and it's normal that we would think, that we would wonder about, that we would even worry then or ruminate about others' outcomes or old stuff. Problem is, God did not create us with the ability to control others' outcomes and old stuff. And yet, that is so often what we get stuck doing. And we become habituated to worrying or trying to control a certain outcome, to get people to treat us a certain way or themselves behave a certain way. We try to control them. Or we get stuck in something that didn't happen the way we wanted it to. We get stuck in some aspect of grief, of old stuff. So the ozone is something that I often want to say, caution, you are entering the ozone, because you don't want to get stuck there. Rather, you want to pay attention to where your thoughts are, but then you want to get back into a healthy sense of yourself with healthy boundaries, tending to the one life that God gave you in this moment, one moment at a time, entrusting Him with the ozone, with the outcomes, with the other people, with helping you to redeem and heal from the old stuff, learn from it, grow from it. So that is what I'm talking about when I am talking about the ozone. And so many wonderful clinicians have gone before me, so many wonderful pastors, theologians, and certainly Scripture itself teaches great stuff about boundaries. So I'm really just kind of repackaging some of those good old truths.
We're putting some roots down, if you will, about gardening our life, how we can just as a plant draws life from the soil, there's water, the sunshine, good gardening, so we draw our lives from God's gift to us here on earth. And we're talking how we can maybe work through and overcome some of the mental health challenges that come into our life day by day. Getting some good insight with Heidi Vermeer-Quist, who's a licensed clinical psychologist, as well as a wife, a mother, and musician, family business owner. We're talking about her new series, book one out, is called Grounding. It's from the Gardening Your Life series. And we're going to continue talking about our fabs in just a moment. Now, we probably need to talk about our abs. We're going to talk fabs. And we'll get to that in just a minute as we continue here on Connecting Faith.
It's not just information, it's transformation.
Well, you could make a choice and listen to a regular radio station that would offer a lot of the typical standard filler, the chatter that you can find on most radio stations. Or you can listen to something like Faith Radio that is going to fill your soul with content and with nourishment. And that's why I would suggest trying to listening to Faith Radio.
Thanks for listening to Faith Radio.
She helped establish the Des Moines Clinic for Pine Rest Christian Mental Health Services. It's grown to a fully staffed outpatient mental health clinic in the Des Moines area. She's a licensed clinical psychologist, a wife, mother, and a musician, businesswoman, and talking with us today about these important concepts. I mentioned the fabs. We can talk. There's something called ants, too. We'll maybe get to that, but let's talk about fabs first.
You know, in our one piece of property, Neil, that we were just talking about, the one life that God gives to us, he gives us three fabulous treasures, F-A-B. We are given the responsibility to manage our feelings, our attitudes, or thoughts. Basically, whatever is ticking off in our mind goes under A. And B, our behaviors. Only one person in the entire universe can really manage those three things in our backyard, and that's what we're responsible for, managing our feelings, our emotions, our attitudes, and our behaviors. Those are the fab treasures, and the great, great, most wonderful good news, which is gospel, that Jesus taught us, was that we're invited to never have to garden even that by ourselves. God invites us to allow him to help us as we manage our feelings, as we manage the thoughts. And sometimes they are ants, to your point earlier. Ants just is automatic negative thoughts. That's what I mean by ants, automatic negative thoughts, kind of like ants in your pants, in a sense. They're not good, right?
Yeah.
So what are my automatic thoughts? Because quite frankly, my thoughts are what produce my feelings. The feelings don't come first. The feelings are produced by however I'm perceiving what's going on, however I'm thinking about it. But then the feelings are very powerful to motivate us towards certain behaviors. And often those behaviors are habits that we've gotten into. Some good habits, potentially, but often some not so healthy habits, or they're habits that we could grow into doing even better behavioral options that are even more mature in our lives.
We often think, maybe incorrectly, we can think like we're victims. But I'm wondering, is it simply a matter of sort of thinking our way out of our problems? I mean, there may be real issues, right? Maybe it's economics or health or those things.
Yeah, so within the book, one of the other repetitive habits, I would say, that I try to encourage the participants, the readers, to utilize is something called fab prayer journaling. So it's sort of like thinking yourself through it, but it's even a little deeper than that. It's actually writing to God, journaling, Dear Lord, this is what I'm feeling, writing out that feeling, giving yourself voice to acknowledging what that feeling is. And it's usually not a good feeling if you're motivated to be journaling about it anyway, although I do encourage people, maybe try to do some fab journaling with happy emotions as well as the negative ones, just to really get more and more comfortable with, again, managing your own fabulous treasures one moment at a time. But then from that feeling, it's very natural then to be able to write out, okay, so what's the situation that I'm facing? And it might be an economic situation. It might be a job situation. It might be a marital situation or a relational situation, so that there is something in life that's happening. So you recognize that there is a situation. Okay, but now let's dig a little deeper. How am I thinking about that? So in the A part of the fab of prayer journaling, think about how am I assuming or interpreting this situation? And am I tending to think of myself as a victim here? Which a lot of times we do, especially in negative situations. We think of ourselves as this is happening to me and I'm a victim and I don't have options. But as we calm ourselves down, Fab Journaling does a great job of that, by the way. When we start writing and we actually start calming ourselves down and we say, okay, so this is my initial interpretation. This is what my knee-jerk reaction is. But wait, now let me think about it a little bit deeper from a rational standpoint of what's just really the truth. You know, is it the end of the world? Do I need to be, you know, doing some extreme, you know, yelling at somebody or taking extreme measures here and fight, flight, that sort of behavior? Or is it maybe, am I maybe making a mountain out of a molehill? Not saying that the molehill is pleasant, but do I have other options of how I can go about this that are probably smarter than what I would have typically done out of my, you know, initial knee-jerk reaction from fear or whatever that feeling is that I'm struggling with, anger, whatever the feeling is. But being able to harness that, kind of rein it in so that then I'm prayerfully with God looking at what's the truth and what are my options so I don't become a victim. I instead realize that, yeah, it's a pretty nasty situation potentially, but I have options. I'm choosing not to be a victim of this situation. I am going to take healthy, good steps to the extent that I, in relationship with God, can do. And then that's when you write out, well, what are my choices? What, you know, my knee-jerk reaction might be to avoid the situation or to lash out. But you and God start to then write out other options. Well, maybe I need to have a conversation with this person. Okay, well, I want to yell at them right now, so maybe today is not a good day to talk to that person. Maybe I should write out what kind of truth and love message might I have to that person, and even practice that with a trusted friend first before I go and talk to the other person that I'm very frustrated with. Hopefully those give some good examples of how it is that you can prayerfully journal out your own fabulous treasures so that you don't get stuck continuing to feel like you're a victim, but actually work through tough situations in a victorious way.
One of the foundational, the core concepts you talk about in gardening your life, and we've sort of touched on it, but maybe you can just dig a little deeper on that, is sort of the tools for managing your thoughts. And you talk about mindfulness, and I know that seems like whenever we talk about that word, people sort of react, well, that's New Age or Eastern religion. So what do you mean by mindfulness?
Mindfulness is not that scary. I'll just say that on the front end. And no religion really has ownership of the term. Mindfulness is very simple. It's putting your mind fully in the present moment. That's it. It's putting your mind fully in the present moment. It's knowing what's going on. You can be mindful of what's going on outside of you. In fact, when people are quite anxious, or quite frankly, also the other extreme, quite depressed, I often encourage them to get in touch with just external mindfulness. Be aware of your five senses right now. What are you touching? What do you hear? What do you see? What do you taste? So get connected in the moment. Get yourself calmed down and mindful in this moment. Again, where we often get lost is that our mind is all over the place. It's not mindfully in the present. We're trying to manage too many things in our mind, and that literally can drive us crazy in some ways. So, it's really this simple concept of being mindful in the moment. So you can be mindful in what you're doing kind of moment by moment. You can also be mindful in terms of what you're doing internally, how you're feeling, thinking, and being. And in a way, the FAB prayer journaling exercise is a great way of being mindful internally. What am I feeling? What are the thoughts that are going on inside of me?
You talked about the journal, and I know you really keep coming back to that at the end of each chapter. How important is it to maybe to kind of rate our progress? I mean, some people maybe aren't always so good at journaling, but there is some value to be able to look back, right, and see where we were and where we've come.
Absolutely, and I think you do. You know, as you do write out these journaling entries, number one, you're affirming your own life. I think you're giving yourself a voice, and you're giving yourself permission to write out part of your story. What's more self-respectful than that, in some ways, right? Rather than just continuing to get sort of lost in the sea of the ozone, others' outcomes, and old stuff, you're taking some time to take stock and take ownership of your one life and to write about it. And then over the course of prayer journaling, you know, days, weeks, months, years, you can see this really awesome journey that you and the Lord are taking together, and you and your Christian brothers and sisters are taking together in community, which is why I encourage very strongly that the book is something that people would do in a group setting rather than just on their own. It's not going to do you any harm to do it on your own, but I do think that Christian community where there's a place of safety and care and mutual desire to grow one's life is really, really, really important.
And, you know, every gardener knows that it takes time and attention to get plants to grow, so we probably need to take a longer-term view than oftentimes we get sort of caught in the moment, right?
Yeah, certainly. And you know, when we're really emotional, we want the easy button from Staples, you know, yeah, where it can be better tomorrow, you know. But no, it takes time. And it's a mystery on how exactly it's gonna grow. You know, you can plant a plant and imagine it growing a certain way, but it's always different than what we imagine it to be, right? Sometimes it's more beautiful and breathtaking, most of the time for me anyway. When I look back on my life and some of the trials God has allowed me to go through, I now give thanks for them because they've been extremely formative. And when I see the things that he's gardened in my life, and I pause and think of the blessings, it's certainly not at all the way I planned my life to go, but I'm actually very thankful to have let go of so much of my old over-controlling tendencies and to just see the miracle of life that he's at work and how wonderful it is to participate in his good gardening then in my own life, and to see it happen in other people's lives is tremendous. It's a great perspective to take toward life, this whole gardening.
It's the final session in this 10-part resource, Giving Thanks for the Showers of Blessings. We're talking grounding. It's part one of the Gardening Your Life series from Heidi Vermeer-Quist. It's available. You can actually write to Heidi, gardeningyourlife@gmail.com. That's the way to get the resource, right?
Yep, that is the best way to get the resource. So if this book sounds interesting to anybody, I'd love to hear from you at gardeningyourlife@gmail.com. And you can find out a little bit more information, too, at vqconsult.com. That's the business that my husband and I run, but we have a button specifically tailored for Gardening Your Life. So just click on the button, and you can read more there, and as well as potentially order the book there as well.
VQConsult.com.
Yep. That'd be VQConsult.com. VermeerQuistConsult.com. VQConsult.
That's a simple website. We'll leave it at that. Our time is gone, Heidi, but it's been a great conversation. Looking forward to hearing more as you continue to develop it. And you've given us a good reminder today about how we can really look at our feelings, attitudes, and behaviors and seek God's purposes in our lives as well.
Thank you so much, Neil. This has been a wonderful discussion with you, and I pray for all of the listeners that they may be blessed to look to their master gardener and enjoy the life that is his gift to them today.
Gardening Your Life is what we're talking about, from Heidi Vermeer-Quist, licensed clinical psychologist And you can find out more at vqconsult.com. You're listening to Connecting Faith.